Hi, this is Gideon Rothstein with a response of a day for the 18th day of Nisan, which is, of course, the third day of Chol HaMoed if you're in Israel for Chag, and the second day of Chol HaMoed if you're outside of Israel. But in the letter that we're about to talk about, there's no mention made of that. Now, this is a tshuva of Rav Chaim David HaLevi. It's from Shut Aseh Lecha Rav, Volume 2, response number 63. And in his way, Rav Chaim David HaLevi doesn't tell us when he's writing the answer. He just says, I'm confirming your receipt of your letter. That's how he starts most of these tshuvot in Aseh Lecha Rav. I confirm receipt of your letter from the 18th day of Nisan, but makes no mention of the fact that it's Chol HaMoed. Maybe the guy who wrote it did or did not either. Let's pause before we jump into the tshuva, which is on the fascinating topic of shul elections. And I mean that seriously. You might think that how can shul elections be fascinating? But the question of how we find our leaders is one that has bothered me for a long time. And how elections work and how they don't work, do or don't work to find appropriate leadership is one that bothers me. I am a person who has more than once in a presidential election voted third party because neither of the candidates seemed to me significantly different enough to justify my voting for them. So I have issues with democracy. So that's an issue. That's why I think perhaps this responsum struck me so deeply. But let's pause to thank the OU, Rabbi Jack Abramowitz and David Hochhauser for their help in making this possible, making our interaction possible. You know, I don't know if it's so much of an interaction because I don't get so many emails about these responsa. I would love to make contact with the listeners and hear from you, know you better a little bit, and have this be somewhat more of a two-way street. My email address is grothst@gmail.com. But let's jump into the tshuva. The letter writer says, he's the representative of a group of people who daven in his shul. Remember, Rav Chaim David HaLevi was the Sephardi chief rabbi of Tel Aviv for a long, long time. So when this guy is writing about his shul, it's not only a halachic question, it's sort of under the governorship in a certain sense of Rav Chaim David HaLevi. So this group in this shul don't like their current administration, not the rabbi, the president, the officers, that administration of the shul. They're unhappy with it. Now let's remember, and this will not be an issue in the responsum, just because they're unhappy doesn't prove that the leadership is bad. It could be that these guys are malcontents. But his claim is that as the election is coming closer for the shul administration, this group, are working to try to get a new administration chosen. So again, you never know. Could be that the old administration is doing their job as best possible and with all dedication, and these people have just decided, I've seen that in shuls many times, where people just decide they know how to do it better, they get into office, turns out they can't do it any better because the challenges facing that shul were just hard challenges, so whatever. But the problem is, and here the current administration doesn't come off so well, but it could be just a lie, he says that some of the people in the administration are known to be powerful and influential people. And they're using this power influence to threaten people that if they don't vote for them, they will, whatever it is they'll do, right? They have the ability to give favors or not give favors, to help people or not help people. And they're doing this because they want to keep the job. It's sort of a reminder of the old story about a guy who's gabai and is complaining about this and about that and how people mistreat him and people aren't nice and they all complain and they come for this and that going on. And somebody says, so why do you keep the job? He says, are you kidding? For the cover. Right, so it's unclear why people are so desperate to hold on to the leadership of a shul. Now, many shuls, you have that problem. I've been in shuls, I've been involved with shuls, where they couldn't find anybody to be president, so they left a guy in position, or, in my case, it was men, but they leave people in position, even though those people are doing a terrible job, and people are, at least, mostly in shul politics, it's a money question. So people will suffer financially because the person will mess up the job. And yet they can't find somebody else. So here, they find somebody else, but the old people want to keep the job. For whatever reason, they want to keep the job. So they're using their power influence to threaten people. And so he says there are people in our shul who recognize that they're not doing a good job, but the fear and the these issues are going to lead them to vote for the old administrations. So what they want, Rabbi Chaim David HaLevi, to weigh in on if there's an election that has this to it, does that election have halachic force? I mean, he's hoping, and Rav Chaim David HaLevi will say, you got to know that if people are using power influence to sway elections, see, in in, let's say, American politics or Israeli politics, there are laws about these things. There are limits that are put on how you can or cannot try to influence people. But in shul, it's much more amorphous. So let's say it was literally true that the guy who is currently treasurer of the shul employs 70 members of the shul in his factory, in his business, in whatever it is. And he lets it be known to them that if he doesn't win the election, they will all, meaning it's a closed vote perhaps, so they can't know who's who. So he says, it doesn't matter. I'm getting rid of all of you. And I'll replace all of you. I can do without all of you. Or I'm 15% cut in everybody's salaries in the business. Or in all 70 of your salaries. That's not right. That's another question. These guys want us, but these guys, so what are you going to do? So you'd like to think that people just stand up to evil whenever they face it, and they do that, but that's not the way life works. And you'd like to think that people would say, you would turn to him and say, you can't do that, and sue him. But it's not the way life works. They're going to vote, because it's a shul election. So they're going to vote for him. So this guy is hoping that they will say the election is invalid if that's going on, and you have to, whatever it is you have to do. So let's see the response. So there are the answer. So the answer is she'ilah zo nishalah b'rishonim. This is an old question. And the truth is, when I used to study Jewish history, it was an issue that people study as well, because the original assumption among Baalei HaTosafot, I think Rabbeinu Tam even, so in the late 1000s, early 1100s, the original assumption was that anything that affects the community, you're supposed to have a unanimous vote. Now that becomes unwieldy very, very quickly, right? Because people are different, and if you have a village of 40 people, maybe you can always get unanimity. But once you get 100 people, 200 people, the idea of unanimity is a pipe dream. So by the time of the Maharam be Rittenberg, so in the Rambam, there's a commentary on the bottom called the Hagahot Mayin Moniot. The Hagahot Mayin Moniot was by a guy named Rav Meir of Rittenberg, but he's not the Maharam. I mean, the Maharam of Rittenberg's name was also the mayor of Rittenberg. This man who wrote the Hagahot Mayin Moniot was a student of the Maharam's, and he was the guy who attended to him when the Maharam was in prison for like 7 years before his death. The Maharam was in prison, and he refused to let people ransom him because he thought that if the community ransomed him from the authorities, they would learn that you put the rabbi in prison, you can get a lot of money out of the Jews. So he refused to let them ransom him. He died in prison. This Rav Meir, also of Rittenberg, also Rav Meir, I think referred to Rav Meir as Cohen. See, he was his student, and he passed away 5 years later in pogroms. And he appended to the bottom of the Rambam the Hagahot Mayin Moniot, which talks about the Ashkenazic views of various issues that the Rambam brings up, not completely dissimilar from what the Ramah later did for the Shulchan Aruch, giving the Ashkenazic understanding of those same issues. And then he also wrote a longer something called the Tshuvot Mayin Moniot, which has some Ashkenazic responsa on topics that come up in the Rambam. Many years ago, I was in a class with Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, and I had always used the two-volume Rambam, and the two-volume Rambam, it turns out, they don't have the Tshuvot Mayin Moniot. And Rabbi Dr. Soloveitchik refers to the Tshuvot Mayin Moniot, and I said, what is that? He said, what do you mean, what is that? It's in the back of your Rambam. I said, I don't look at that. He said, you don't flip through the book? So it's a reminder, maybe you should flip through the book just to know what's in the book. Now, it happens to be I saved myself because the two-volume Rambams don't have the Tshuvot Mayin Moniot, and I never used one of the bigger five-volume Rambams. So I got off the hook a little bit. In any case, in the Hagahot Mayin Moniot, too, the laws of prayer. He also has one in Tshuvot Mayin Moniot of Sefer Kinyan. There's a tshuva about it, which says that if there's an argument among the community and they can't come to a unanimous agreement about who the leadership should be, right? That was the original model. You want unanimous leadership, which is such an interesting idea because it means that they really had very small communities, because it's really hard to imagine that you'd have, as a regular factor in communal politics, a unanimous vote for who the leadership should be. In any case, so you can't get it, and it's getting to be a problem because since they can't find leadership together, so he writes, Batel HaTamid, the davening's being bothered, because people don't have leadership, and you don't have any enforcement of like communal standards and stuff because people need leadership. So if you can't agree on the leadership, you don't have leadership, right? So there are shuls that I know of where they say, oh, we love not having leaders. But hey, it might be a problem with, the legal side of it, at least in America. But when there's no leadership, then it's a hefker world. And a hefker world doesn't work. But leadership has its laws as well. So that's why it goes back and forth. So the Maharam is writing, the mayor of Rittenberg is representing the Ashkenazic view that it can't go without leadership. You need leadership to a community and to a city and to a kingdom. So he says, here's what you should do. All the taxpayers, that's an interesting comment in America. That idea of taxpayers was used often as a way to exclude certain races of people. And in that sense, got a very bad reputation. And land ownership was often used as a standard. So here, when they talk about nimas, about taxpayers, so I think it's an interesting question to think about, because when the people who don't pay taxes, for whatever reason they don't pay taxes, so you say, well, why shouldn't they get the vote? The answer, and I don't think it's a wrong answer, the answer to that question is, well, if you don't pay taxes, you don't have a stake in it. And the vote of people who don't have a stake in anything is a different vote, meaning it's like, I actually was just in a conversation where somebody pointed out, and I think it's a very important, valid point, when lawmakers have to decide, or presidents have to decide whether to send people to war, it's a different question if they have friends and relatives who are going to be going to that war, or they don't. Right? When you have a stake in something, then the stake, so if I have a financial stake in a community, and now I'm making financial decisions for that community, that will be different. So, for example, let's say a shul decides to do a construction project. And the person who's running, who's the person in charge of making decisions about the project, knows that no matter what happens, his donation is $1,000. If the project costs $5 million, he's giving $1,000. If the project costs $20 million, he's giving $1,000. If the project costs $100,000, he's giving $1,000. As he makes decisions now, his connection to the financial issues is going to be looser than it otherwise could be. So, sorry, I'm getting a little bit too astray, and I don't want to run out of time on the tshuva. Therefore, the Hagoah Maimonides says what they should do is, everybody gets together, the Notnei Hamas, the people who are taxpayers, and they accept upon themselves Acherim, which people used to believe in, that when a community declares Acherim, that means that Hashem will punish, and they all will punish. If they ever find out that somebody didn't do what they're about to say, that everybody has to say Da'ato L'Shem Shamayim L'Takanat Ha'ir, that you have to give your opinion for the best that you can imagine that would be good for the community. That's a very important standard. Because a lot of people, I think, in American democracy assume, I vote however I want to. And where the answer is supposed to be, you're supposed to be thinking about what's best for, and you're supposed to be really thinking about it. You're supposed to be doing your sincere best to figure out what's best for the United States of America. Now, sometimes people convince themselves that what's best for them personally has to be what's best for the country or the community or the shul or the city or whatever it is. And if they've convinced themselves, and they're really convinced of that, then that's a different discussion, but it's not this discussion. So the point was, you make a solemn oath, as it were. You announce in front, ahead of time, that anybody in the community who makes a vote that's not for that pure purpose of doing what's best for the community, should have a chayr, should be banned, should be excommunicated, and then they vote, and the majority wins. And there are more paskins in Choshen Mishpat, by the way, based on this Hagolat Maimonides, that anybody refuses to accept the chayrim, or refuses to share their opinion, al pi chayrim, but la da'ato. I'm sorry, so in that situation, they're supposed to each say their opinion in front of the community. I mean, we today talk about closed vote. The reason for closed votes, there are good reasons for it, because people will threaten people, exactly as might have happened in this community. People will threaten people this. But the Mara, the Hagolat Maimonides, and the Ramah, we're talking about an open vote. You make a chayrim, everybody says their opinion, and they give their reasonings for it, and you follow the majority. The Ramah says, you're not willing to say your opinion, then you don't get a vote, and then you follow the majority of the people who were willing to speak up. These are all different choices that you can make. I'm not saying that they're right and we're wrong in the way we do things. I'm just pointing out the way that they understood it at the time. So the Rav Chaim David Levi says is, if you come to a meeting like that, and let's say one of the sides convinces somebody with their logic, with their reasoning, with what they said to support their candidacy, even if you came in, so let's say in this shul that had written the letter, this shul group, the new group thinks that they're much better. They get to the meeting, and the old group gets up and makes really convincing arguments, aside from the job issue, aside from the power and influence issue. They lay out what they've been trying to do. They lay out what the challenges have been. They lay out how they're working and how they're going, and they convince people that really they are good. Everybody assumed that they were stupid and terrible and bad. They convince people they were good. And he's really doing it, L'Shem Shemayim. L'Shem Shemayim again means with all sincerity, as far as the best result can get, then you're allowed to vote for them, and there's no problem to vote for them, even though you thought you would do something to begin with. But if somebody knows, now Rav Chaim Golovin writes, Mistirei Libo, right? A lot of these questions are, what's going on deep down inside your heart? And so sometimes people know what's going on in their heart, and they try to suppress it, and they try to convince themselves, right? Yeah, I don't want to be a person who admits that I'm just afraid of the guy. Nah, he's the worst job, he's bad for this job, he's bad for the community, but I'm afraid of him, not even, let's say, a job. I'm afraid of him in the sort of amorphous sense of, who knows what he could do to me? He's a rich, powerful guy. Who knows, one day maybe he could do me a favor. Who knows if he could hurt me? I'm just afraid. So that person is supposed to, is supposed to realize that voting is really somewhat of a sacred responsibility. It's a part of you're a small part maybe, but you're a part of making decisions for a community or a nation or a state or whatever it is, and you have to take that job seriously, and you have to do it to the best of your ability. Now, he throws in that we should look at a tshuva in the Chatam Sofer, and it's such a fascinating tshuva. And he writes short tshuva of Chaim David Levi. We have enough space, I hope, to review briefly the tshuva in the Chatam Sofer. The Chatam Sofer is from Volume 5 in the Choshen Mishpat section, and Siman Kuf Samach, response number 160. And the case there was, the community is trying to pick a new rabbi. And when they're trying to pick the new rabbi, they came up with a system where they got four finalists, right? A lot of shuls have finalists, and then you vote. But they didn't do that. They had four finalists. They put the names of the four finalists in like a lottery, basically, in like, you know, one of those bowls. And you reach out, you pluck out a name. And the name you pluck out, you have an up or down vote on that guy. If you got a majority, he was the rabbi. If not, you went into the next guy. So they did this procedure. First guy got rejected. Second guy got rejected. The third guy wins. So you think he's the rub. But soon after that, there was a rumor that a lot of people had been paid, had been bribed by relatives of this third guy, this rabbi who had won the vote, to vote for him. And then, worse than that, one of the people in the town sent a letter to his brother, who lived in the same town as this new rabbi, meaning you elected a rabbi, he's going to come move to your town, but right now he's the rabbi somewhere else. So he had one of the town people in this town had a brother in that other town. He sent him a letter, and the way that it's said in the tshuva is v'yan ki hirgishu anshei hakahal shimtzu bo davar seter, since they had the sense that they would find some secret in there. So today it would be sort of akin to getting a search warrant, right? You get a search warrant to open his mail. They open the mail, and it says there that he's asking his brother, who lives in another town, of the rabbi that, who had accepted his share of the bribe, he should please quickly send him the money, and he should send all the money for all the other people who had been bribed as well. So now the members of the community get together, they're all upset. They've elected a rav. Turns out that some portion, significant but not necessarily majority, although not necessarily not majority, they don't know how many people, but some significant portion of the population had accepted bribes. So now the people who weren't bribed for it, they want to not have this guy be their rabbi. They don't like the whole process. So they come to Chatam Sofer and they say, we want to throw out the whole procedure, and what should we do? Chatam Sofer says he's trying to find a way to bring peace back to this community. It's just a compromise. So first of all, he says that if you have two witnesses that there was bribery going on, then you can get rid of the vote. And the guy's not going to be the rabbi, even though it's not his fault necessarily. We'll get back to that in a second. But the vote is batel. The vote is nullified but that was an important qualification. You need two witnesses who are not members of the community. Why do you need two witnesses who are not members of the community? Because all the members of the community are nogim badavar. They have a stake in this. Either they want the rabbi, they don't want the rabbi, they were bribed, they weren't bribed, but they all have a stake in this. And it can't be relatives of the community, and it can't be relatives of the rabbi. Because in halacha, in order to give testimony in a court case, you can't be a person who has a stake in the case, because we think that will always shape your testimony. So it could easily happen, the Chatam Sofer is pointing out, that you might think that something happened, but you won't have a Beitin way of proving it, and then you're going to be stuck. Many people think that you're stuck and you have to keep the rabbi and just do whatever you're going to do, but you have to keep the rabbi. And the reason you'd have to do that is because you don't have any proof of something. In halacha, proof is a very important thing. Now, if it turns out you have proof that people got bribed, so then the whole thing should be thrown out, he says. And the reason the whole thing is thrown out is because if you know that there are people who are bribed to take the third guy, they voted no on the first two because they had to get to the third guy. So it might be that one of the first two would have won. So that isn't fair, right? And that isn't right. And therefore, you have to go back and do the whole thing over again. Now, what would happen? I'm sorry. Let's just stick with the Chatam Sofer, because I am letting myself go a little too long with my time. But it's worth thinking about what would happen if they didn't have witnesses. What does that mean in halakha? There are times when we strongly suspect something, but we don't have enough proof of it to act on it, and how do we react to that, and how do we act in our lives? That's the topic, God willing, for maybe another time. So now, you've got this vote. Now, you could say, let's suppose that there weren't that many people who accepted the bribes, and that most of the people actually voted for this rabbi, most of the people who voted for the rabbi were people who had accepted bribes. So you could say, sure, but the fact that we turned down the first two, it's because you guys voted against the first two, and now I was stuck with maybe the fourth guy is good. If I vote down the third guy, I'm going to, meaning in this process, you vote up or down on each of the four candidates, the fourth guy is almost definitely going to be the guy, or a lot of people vote for him because he's the last option, and otherwise you're going to have to throw out the whole vote and start all over again. So some of the people who voted for the third guy could say that was because the first two guys lost. Now, again, you could say, well, that was only because of minorities, apparently, but the point is that the way the process worked, the whole process was sullied. And it happens to be, if you have witnesses or proof that this Rav himself was part of the scheme, he said, yeah, give the bribes, then he can't be a Rav anywhere, let alone here. And so he won't be part of this process going forward at all, because he's going to have to wait until he does tshuva. That idea of doing tshuva and when we can accept tshuva or not tshuva to return to a position is a very important thought. I recently read a wonderful article in a Tradition magazine that had a special issue on sexual abuse. And there was a wonderful article by, I think, Shira Berkovitz about the nature of tshuva and how tshuva could or couldn't work. So Chatzam Sofer doesn't go into it. He says until the guy does tshuva from this, and tshuva means not just he says sorry, but he convincingly changes his ways such that we can be sure he's not the kind of guy who's going to return to this anymore, so then maybe he could be a Rav somewhere. But otherwise, he's out of this process. And he points out that in Yoma, the Gemara talks about a guy named Yehoshua ben Gamla. Yehoshua ben Gamla is, I think, well known for being the one who first instituted a sort of public education and required all communities to have a Melamei Tinokot, to have some kind of an elementary school system, as long as they had a certain number of kids in the community. So he's generally seen as a good guy who did good stuff. But he ascended to the position of Kohen Gadol, of high priest, through a kind of political influence or bribery. This is in the end of the second Beit HaMikdash, when the Romans had already taken some control of Eretz Yisrael, so all of these appointments became very politicized, and he became politicized. So the Chatam Sofer points out that the Tosfot Yeshanim in Yoma talks about Yehoshua ben Gamla, who was an important person and may have been worthy of being Kohen Gadol, and he was righteous. So he says, even if, and the way, there's a Gemara that talks negatively of him for having taken the position of Kohen Gadol through a bribery process, through a politicized process, and him wielding political influence rather than just getting the job. So if there was a better candidate for the job, we called him a Rasha. That's a, right? So imagine, there's seven people who are at all qualified. You're the second best candidate, the third best candidate. You think to yourself, but I can do a great job. And it's true you can do a great job. And so you find a political way or a bribery way to get the job. The Gemara of Tosi Shonim Yoma says, we would refer to such a person as a Rasha because he wasn't the best for the job. He shouldn't have taken it. He shouldn't have, well, if they had picked him anyway, he could have taken it, but he shouldn't. And the Bach says, the Bach goes further and says the truth is, even if he was the best guy for the job, he's called a Rasha for the fact that he got the job, and he's called a Rasha, and you're not allowed to stand up for him out of honor because he's called a Rasha for the fact that he got the job in an inappropriate way. That's a long conversation about ends and means and when the means ends can or cannot justify the means. But here the Bach is saying that to use bribery to get the job of Kohen Gadol is not allowed, even if, meaning, let's say you're living in a world where you are in fact the best candidate for a job, but in fact the people who make the decision are going to make a bad decision. The temptation to say to yourself, I'm actually producing the best result. And so a lot of times people are arrogant. They think they're the best when they're not really the best. That's not what we're talking about here. We are stipulating that the person involved is in fact the best for the job. The Bach's feeling was, you're still a Rasha if you use inappropriate means to get that job. I think that's a far-reaching and important discussion that applies to many, many areas of life, not just to becoming the Kohen Gadol. So you have Tosfos Shanim in Yoma, who thinks that you're a Rasha if you use influence, if there's somebody better than you, not that you're bad. It's just as long as there's somebody better than you. And the Bach thinks even if there's nobody better than you. Now, if there are no witnesses about this rabbi, that he was involved in the bribery, so again, without proof in halakha, we can't just assume something about somebody. So the fact that his brother and his father and his sister and whoever it is arranged this whole bribery scheme, it's a pretty elaborate scheme, and, you know, see everybody in his family involved in it, might give a lot of circumstantial evidence that he was involved in it, but unless we know, have some way to know that he was involved in it, we can't keep him out of the process. We have to assume that he's a good guy because we have no evidence against him. So that's a thing to think about. And this is an important factor for the Chatam Sofer. At the beginning, everybody agreed, like the community agreed, they had four candidates. How'd they get the four candidates? They had some process to get to the four candidates. He made it into the four, and there is no evidence in this discussion that there was bribery even to get him to be a candidate. He made it into the candidacy. The candidacy itself seems to have been valid. Now we don't have any proof that he was a bad guy. So then the Chatam Sofer says something that I don't quite understand. He says, V'yimaneh ha-kahal mi-chadash al shalosh eila. That community should vote from among these three, and whoever gets the most votes. Now here, he doesn't say do the whole lottery procedure again. He just says vote among the three. Now I have to say, if I were talking to Chatam Sofer, I would wonder about why the fourth guy gets left out. I think his answer would be because the fourth guy definitely wasn't voted on. But the same way that we think the first two were unfairly excluded, I think the fourth guy was unfairly excluded because some number of voters was hell-bent on getting the third guy into the position. So I would have thought you go back to all four. In any case, he says all three. And then he says, the people who got the bribes, they can't be part of that meeting. So apparently we know of some of them. I think, I don't know if you know of all of them, but you know of some of them. So the people, the list of people who took the bribes, they can't be there. And they can't be there, since there's a fair, even if they return the bribe money, even if they take, this is what was done in Jewish communities, you take a public oath, and people used to care about their public oath, and used to really be able to trust that somebody was willing to trust to take an oath in public to an issue that they would, that you could trust that their, you know, their word was their bond, as it were. This is in times gone by. If they made a public oath, they're never going to take bribes again, right? They still can't be part of this vote. And it may be, says the Chatam Sofer, that they can't be part of any communal votes until they do a full tshuva, which means more than just saying sorry. It means it means acting in ways when nobody knows about it, when it's not, it can't possibly be for the purpose of proving to people that you've done tshuva. Just it becomes clearly known and clearly understood that this person has fully changed their ways. Maybe then you could come back to communal votes. But for this vote, Chazal says they can never come back. And the reason he gives is so interesting. You might have thought it's because they can't do tshuva. That's not what he says. What he says is, and I think this is such an insight into human psychology, he says in this vote, they've already sort of, they've shaped their minds to be prone to liking this guy. Meaning it started with a bribe. But once they get the bribe, then they want to convince themselves, meaning, if I have to look myself in the mirror and say, listen, I am such a venal person, venal or venial, I am such a person who's so interested in money, that I am willing to take money and not care about who the rabbi of the shul is, and give the community a bad rub. You don't want to say that to yourself. So what do you say? No, he's a good guy. After all, he was one of the four, right? So the community thought he was one of the four, and I like him a lot. I just take money because why wouldn't they take money? So that means they'll have a stake in the vote coming up. Meaning, let's suppose you took away all the bribe people out of the community, and that guy ended up winning anyway. And let's say that all the other people weren't bribed. So they all agreed that he was the best guy, or a majority of them agreed he was the best guy. As a bribe-taking person, I'll feel better about myself because I took a bribe, sure, but I took a bribe to help the best guy get into the position. Isn't that good? And people think of that as sort of a good thing. And therefore, they can't be it because they're always going to have a stake in it coming out in a way that lessens the crime, the evil that they did. So now let's suppose the majority of the community took the bribes and they're going to say, but this isn't fair. The minority is going to get to pick who our rabbi is. The answer is, so the Chatzim doesn't say yes, which would, my answer would have been, yes, because you disqualified yourselves. Tough luck, you have to bear the consequences. That's not quite what he says. What he says is, but you all agreed to put all of these other candidates in the group. So each of the four was somebody the community seemed to think could theoretically do the job. And therefore, it's not such a big deal. It's not such a big loss. And therefore, you have to deal with it this way. But if you don't have witnesses for that, you have to leave the Rav in his place. And that's even if the people who accepted the bribe and the relatives of the Rav and all of them say, no, the Rav was involved too. right? They can't say it because they are nogim badavar. They're not valid witnesses on this, and they don't have the halachic ability to bear testimony against him and to lose himself and to lose him the job because they can't give any testimony about it. So the best that could happen then is the members of the community can say, we're announcing a cherem stam, an excommunication, and the belief was, and the hope was, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if people in the community didn't act on it, HaKadosh Baruch Hu would act on it, and that's sort of part of it was really a running undercurrent of Jewish communities. It's sort of been lost, I think, in most communities today. You know, in shuls that I know of, if you stood up and said, I'm announcing a cherem stam, people would say, yeah, who cares? But the point was, they really believed in it. They believed that if you announce a cherem stam and you're the person who qualifies to be excommunicated in that way, in some sense, you're already excommunicated. So here, they would announce a cherem stam on anybody who knows that this guy was appointed through bribery that he himself did, should not take a job like that. So they want the Rav to understand. So now, that would be a complicated position for that Rav. If he finds himself, let's say he's innocent, he finds himself with relatives who bribe people on his behalf, and he's going to have to take the community is going to suspect him forever. Then, man, that's a complicated rabbinate. So I don't know what you would do about that. In any case, that's what the Chatam Sofer wrote to this community about vote. Now, the Rav Rav Chaim David Alevi, back in his tshuva, Aseh Lecharav, we have just a very little bit left, he says, he made reference to the tshuva, and he says, so you can also do that. You have a cherem. You announce a cherem before the shul vote, and I assume they were going to have a closed vote. So it wasn't a cherem, you have to say your opinion, l'shem shemayim. It's a cherem, you have to vote, l'shem shemayim. You have to vote your conscience. You have to vote what you really believe is the right way for it to work. So if somebody says, listen, I'll vote my conscience, but I'm not willing to accept a cherem like that, you're not required to believe such a person, and you can say you can't be part of the vote then, and you'll vote without that person. So Chaim David Levi is saying you're allowed to require people to accept upon themselves that if they're going to do something that's not their full conscience of what they're doing, that they should be put in cherem min hashamayim, basically. They should be excommunicated from heaven and for the community. If we know you're doing it, if it ever comes out that you did it for reasons other than the purest motives of your best understanding what's good for the shul, that's what you can do. And therefore, he says, you should let everybody know that when you're all alone in that voting booth and you're there and writing it down, it's got to be your best conscience. And then he reminds us of the opening of Rambam's words, not opening, towards the end of the morning of Bukhim. Kol shekin kishi yasim adam el libo sham melech hagadol asher malach melech asher malo kol aretz kevodo. All the more so that if a person really keeps in mind that the great king, who the earth is filled with his honor, meaning Kodesh Baruch Hu Hashem, is standing there, as it were, and watching and sees everything we do, that'll shape what we do. So Rav Chaim David Levi says we should remind people of this as they go to vote as well. And he says, "Kedai shetikra igeret zot pozne kehal habokrim." As you come together to vote, read my letter. So they all remember that Halacha says that when you vote, you got to vote your best conscience, your best understanding, and what's for the good of the community. And that's where you have to go. And that's where he closes the letter. And that's the way we're going to close our responsive day for the 18th of Nisan. Thank you to the OU. Thank you, Rabbi Jacob Bronowitz. Thank you, David Achauser. Thank you for listening. My name is Gideon Rothstein. This has been a responsive day, and have a great day.